Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everybody, it is Amber Love from Vodka O'Clock Podcast and AmberUnmasked.com. Don't forget, we are labeled as an explicit website and podcast. So returning to Vodka O'Clock, I love when I have return guests. It's Jeremy Holt. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's pretty exciting.
So, we're going to talk about a lot of things, but first off the bat is your newest comic book project, and I want you to give the listeners a rundown so that we can talk about this very cool subject matter that you have here.
Sure.
So is this first of all an image book or?
No, it's as much as I'd like it to be. Right now, I'm currently self-publishing it. There is interest from publishers, but until that gets kind of until that ink dries,
okay.
I'm just kind of pushing through and doing it myself.
Okay, so give us the title and the pitch.
So the title is After Houdini, and it's a semi-biographical action adventure that follows the estranged son of Harry Houdini, who, other than being the world's most famous magician, is also a covert spy for American and British intelligence during World War I.
Okay, so then which part of this is actually true?
Harry Houdini, obviously everyone knows. He did not have a son. That is the fictitious part of the story. And there are theories that I've done some research on, a lot of research actually, that he was actually involved with covert operations while doing his world tours between the years of 1900 and 1907. He was friends with Teddy Roosevelt. He had friends at Scotland Yard. He knew British intelligence. So he was relaying information. Some theorize that he was doing this. So whether it's true or not, that's up to for debate. But a book that I'd read is called The Secret Life of Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero, which is by these authors, William Kalush and Larry Sloman, that are huge Houdini fans, and their research is impeccable about his life and his career, but this book was kind of the framework and the jumping-off point for me to come up with this idea of Houdini being a spy. And I decided to take that one step further and focus the story on his son, because I thought that readers would be it would be easier for them to align with a character that they know nothing about. It's one thing to make Harry the main character, which at the very beginning that was the idea with the artist Kevin Ziegler, but we realized that character in himself is too big, and there's just too much about him, and people have their own ideas of who he was, what he did, how he died, and I didn't really want to kind of meddle with that. I just wanted to start fresh with a new character.
Okay, that was sort of leads into what I was going to ask you about writing historical fiction, basically, is because I'm sort of in the process of doing the exact same thing, only with people far less famous. And I am afraid of, like, butchering the real facts, but trying to fit it into this fake part of, you know, this fake plot line that I have.
Yeah, it is really challenging, and I was really nervous about it at first because I didn't know if, A, I'd find enough material, or B, there'd be too much material, and I didn't know where to go with it. It ended up being a lot of material that I found, and the idea of focusing on his son and kind of adding more fantastic elements, adding the idea that magic is real, and that's something that was perhaps in my story, it is the greatest trick that Harry figured out, was that magic is real. It is a tangible force that you can tap into, and that took me, I'd say, months before I kind of accepted that idea, because I really wanted, like you said, to stay with the material, but at the same time, I didn't want it to be like this boring biography. So.
Yeah, I completely understand. Like, you know, these people that I've been researching, there was only so much information I was able to find without, you know, maybe going actually like and doing very in-depth Hall of Records searches. I'm trying to just work off of what I can find on the internet. And I'm like making up spouses and children because I'm like, well, this is what I need.
Yeah, I mean, like, really all you need to do is, as you know, if there's a historical timeline, which is something that I've kind of mapped out, and I decided to set it in a specific year, And by doing that, it kind of helps you. It's a guide to determine who's going to be involved in the story, what historical characters you want to include to kind of ground it in reality. But, you know, I've gotten to a point where I've got my key players. I know who I want to include so people know. Like the first three pages, you see Woodrow Wilson, which is, you know, obviously a president everybody might recognize. And that kind of sets the tone in the time period without having to kind of say it. You know, I'm kind of the method of show, don't tell.
Right.
But yeah, as long as you kind of sprinkle moments of historical fact, I think that's really all you need to do to keep the reader grounded. And it was actually a lot of fun because the dates I was looking up and historical events were lining up perfectly with my story. And it was really eerie. Like, I'd say there's like half a dozen emails between me and Kevin where he'd send me something. He's like, dude, this happened right on the month that we're talking about. I'm like, did it really? And I'd look it up. I'm like, oh my God, that's crazy. Like, I can't even make this stuff up. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've heard of artists going so far as to check proper moon phases so that their art is accurate. And I'm like, wow, that's just nuts.
Yeah, for sure.
So after Houdini, what is your plan for formatting this and releasing it? Do you have, like, you know, a set number of issues and everything worked out?
Yeah, it's right now it's going to be 5 issues at the standard 22-page length. I've already outlined the whole thing. I actually just finished scripting issue 3 today. But it does lead into a bigger story, and it's something Kevin and I had agreed upon before we started working on this, was that we see 3 story arcs, 3 5-issue arcs, so 15 issues total. Whether we get that far, we'll have to see, but we are committed to finishing the first arc. And this was actually an idea that Kevin brought to me. Him and I had been working for a while, and I actually met him through Trad Moore, who's, you know, become quite well-known in the industry because of his art. And Kevin and Trad were actually college roommates. And they actually went to the same art school I went to, but they were a whole generation after me. I graduated in 05. They graduated in 2010, so they're much younger. But Trad was like, yeah, you need to work with Kevin. He needs to make comic books. That's what he should be doing. So we worked on different books, Kevin and I, for about a year and a half to 2 years, and it just, nothing really gelled. He just wasn't fully committed to some of the ideas I was pitching him. So it got to a point where I was like, okay, what do you want to draw? And he's like, I really love Harry Houdini, and I have this idea. I was like, okay. And then from there, we just kind of started spitballing ideas, and that's how it all started.
That's actually advice that I hear from veteran writers all the time when it comes to how to woo an artist is ask them what they want to draw. That's what we learn in Comics Experience, and that's, you know,
it's the easiest way to get an artist to commit to a project because they feel invested, and honestly, I want an artist to feel invested. I want it to be completely collaborative because, you know, I've done the whole page rate, and I respect people that go down that route and only work that way, but I never got good results from artists working that way. And I want, you know, to share that ownership with someone. And, you know, it just makes it more fun because then, you know, I actually build a friendship with someone. And Kevin and I have become really good friends, and we actually met for the first time at HeroesCon a few weeks ago, and it was really cool to finally meet in person, but we kind of felt like we'd known each other for a while.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're going to be working on a project for, you know, possibly a year or more, you know, depending on if this is a full-time job or not.
Right.
And you definitely need to know that you can work together. And obviously, people are going to disagree on stuff. All project teams do. But if you disagree in such a way that you produce better results, that's the goal.
Sure. For sure.
But the, you know, like I'm always panicked about, you know, this script that I'm working on because it's just a story that I want to do. I'm like, well, I might not find anybody who cares about this. I don't know if I have an artist. You know, but we're going to get into a little bit of art talk in just a bit. I want to talk about Houdini a little bit more. Well, are you going to release this digitally, I'm assuming?
Yeah, it's going through Challenger Comics right now, which is a self-publishing publisher through Ryan Ferrier is the guy who's kind of running the whole show, and he's a great writer in his own right. He's got a lot of exciting projects coming out in the fall, and him and I have been working together for about a year now. He's been lettering a lot of my projects, and he was kind enough to put it out through his website, and I decided to go that route rather than, say, submitting it to Comixology, because the issue that I released is a black and white issue. Colors are happening, are kind of getting together this month and next month. But other than that, I do, the interest that I'm getting from some publishers, I didn't want to make, it just felt way too official to put it up on Comixology, because then I wouldn't know how to take it down if I had to. And with Ryan, it's just kind of like very personal and easy to, you know, figure things out and change things if you wanted to. So for now, I'm just really happy doing that.
Okay, and then the ultimate goal would be, you know, a print collection. Yes. for, you know, it's one of those things where one of the reasons that print will never die is because we like to go to a booth at a con and buy stuff and have it signed.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's, you know, until people are, you know, e-signing tablets or something, you know, and being able to purchase on the spot at a booth for some reason. Like, if you're sitting there at a booth and you're given a code immediately, you know, but that's, I don't know what the cash process of that would be like. All I can picture in my head is the, you know, the lifestyle in Batman Beyond.
Yeah, and the thing is, with tablets and iPads, I think it's great. I am convinced I need to get one just to read digital comics, but, you know, everyone says they're great, but no one talks about the trade. Like, if you pick up a trade paperback, I wouldn't want to read that on an iPad. I personally like having them on my shelf, and I collect comic books, and I get the whole argument with single issues. Like, it's harder to store them, and, like, it just kind of accumulates, and you don't know what to do with them. And, yeah, I get it. iPads are great for single issues when you're getting them every Wednesday, but when you get a collector's volume, I'd want to buy it, so... You know, I don't think print's going anywhere for a while.
Yeah, definitely not. And it's interesting that that whether it's the creator's choice or publisher's, mostly creator's, I think, choice, that they're offering different versions.
Yes.
You know, that if you get one or the other, you might get different backup features or, you know, concept art or, you know, things like that. And then there's the whole Kickstarter crowdsourcing version, where a lot of things have their own exclusive content for the people who have backed the project to begin with.
Yeah, I can see the appeal of Kickstarter. I mean, I'm in the process of finding a colorist for After Houdini, and you know, I think I have a couple people that are serious considerations, and one of them was mentioning a page rate, not that he'd need it up front, but more back end. And I was doing the math, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's a lot of money. Like, I need to make sure this book sells, or I'm just going to be paying this out of pocket. So I can see the appeal of Kickstarter when you can kind of get that crowdfunding up front and make sure your team gets paid.
So. Yeah, I was sort of looking at that, too, and I almost had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Because if I'm looking at strictly, you know, like, if I'm strictly doing, like, a work-for-hire thing, I'm just like, yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's crazy, and like, to be honest, like, Kevin and I feel so fortunate working with him, and the other thing is that because it was kind of his idea, and he didn't know how to progress it, and we kind of progressed it together, you know, we both understand that, look, we're probably not going to get paid for this, but we're not doing it to get paid. This is a story he's been wanting to tell for years now, and this is something that I'm very excited to tell since I've been writing it and researching it and all that. So, you know, it's a struggle. Like, him and I were talking about this yesterday, like, life gets in the way, and, like, it can kill your productivity sometimes. But when him and I both think of this comic and we think of this story, we get excited about it. And that's the best situation I could ask for.
So who are your favorite illusionists besides Houdini? Do you have any other favorites?
I don't really know, actually. The only magic act I'd ever seen, I saw David Copperfield live once when I was a kid, and I thought it was pretty amazing, but I think I was too young to really grasp what was happening, because the only trick I remember him doing was he was on a motorcycle on stage, and then somehow, in the blink of an eye, he's got the motorcycle on the balcony of this theater, and he's sitting on it. And I remember thinking, wow, that's magic. But like, I didn't really think about, yeah, you know, sleight of hand or all the technical aspects. But yeah, I honestly don't follow magic enough to have a favorite. I did have a roommate in college who was really big into illusions, and actually one of the tricks in the first issue of the comic is a trick that I watched my roommate do at parties all the time, where he would have you pick 5 cards from the deck. You'd have to conceal them, put them in your back pocket, whatever, your shoe, and then he'd, you know, make the cards disappear one by one, and he'd transfer cards to you, and it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen, because I just didn't understand how it was done. So, yeah, I've had, you know, experience with magic firsthand, but you know, I didn't really grow up with, like, favorites or anything.
I think if I ever, you know, just, like, sort of had that windfall of money, I'd definitely go and hit up the Magic Castle.
Yeah.
I've heard such great things about the shows there. It just sounds like such a special place where, you know, everybody gets all dressed up, and it's, you know, and then there's like a special area that you have to be in, like the Magician's Guild.
Really?
To even get into, because it's like a private club just for them. But just the thought of seeing the performances seems really cool.
No, for sure. I had just seen that movie, Now You See Me. And which was actually really entertaining. I thought the love story was a little weak, but the illusions were really creative. And the guy that they had enlisted as a consultant, actually, my fiance knew him through a job or something, and he's kind of made a big name for himself now out in L.A. But his illusions are pretty cool. He does this thing where he does a magic act that involves crossword puzzles. I'll send you the link on who this is, but it's really kind of amazing, because it's like, it's taking kind of old ideas of magic and making them more modern, so they're in a context that's, you know, a little bit more interesting other than just cards, you know, and everyone loves a crossword, so when you can kind of factor in something magical about that, it's pretty neat.
I got really obsessed once I discovered Darren Brown. He's a British illusionist and mentalist, and all of his stuff is like up on YouTube. And
oh no, I think I know exactly who you're talking about. Yeah,
yeah. And he's had a bunch of different television specials and series and stuff, but he's just literally hypnotic just to watch him, because he studies so hard, studying the beat of when to say every single word that he says, and when to, you know, when and how to move his body and move his arms and stuff. Literally, it is all so carefully worked out. And I'm also like, I love the show The Mentalist. So a lot of times you'll get like little tricks and stuff just by watching that show, because it's all about how fake it is.
Sure, sure.
And the commentary on the DVD, you know, tracks, they have Apollo, the guy who's like helped train the crew and the cast and everything. So I started following these people on Twitter. I'm like, oh my God, this must be like the greatest life ever. Like, I can't imagine, like, you know, learning to pickpocket. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's the littlest things, you know, it starts off small, carnival-esque, mm-hmm. you know, the sidewalk magicians. And,
yeah. That's actually how Houdini started. He was part of, a traveling, I wouldn't call it a circus. It was more kind of I don't know the term for it, but he would do small little acts with his wife, Bess. And, you know, what was amazing about him was that he introduced the idea of danger within magic, and he had the audience kind of, you know, he was a really great showman, so he would get you invested in the idea that what you're about to witness is someone's death. And today that doesn't seem that crazy, because, you know, we see crazy stuff on, you know, 300 different channels a day, but the fact that he did this was just, you know, inspiring, and he was, you know, perhaps the most famous person on the planet at one point. Like, everybody knew who he was, and that's that's pretty amazing considering he was a magician. Like, he was doing a trade that, you know, most people didn't really know anything about.
Yeah, and how he's just literally inspired the, you know, so many people. There's just countless amounts of people. I mean, I always think of, you know, the Prestige and the Illusionist.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, then you have, like, these the real performers, like Darren Brown and certainly guys like Penn and Teller.
Sure, sure.
But then you were just talking about introducing the danger factor, and we've had all these crazy reality shows about kind of self-harm, if you think about it, or at least dares to a very extreme extent, like Fear Factor. And, you know, hey, those, there's guys that chew glass,
yeah.
You know, and they do, yeah. They do this. I see this at steampunk shows all the time because it's very carnival-esque.
Yeah.
For steampunk shows, there's always the straitjacket escapes going on, and they do amazing fire performances. So, when I saw somebody chewing glass in New York one time, I was cringing. I'm like, oh my goodness, I know that there are things that you've trained your body to do. I'm like, but I just, it's hard to watch. It's hard to hear because they always, you know, put the microphone right up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it desensitizes you for sure. I mean, the stuff that Houdini was doing, I mean, it was just amazing for the time period. I mean, particularly just photographs that he was in, like he was basically more or less almost naked, covered in chains. I mean, at that time period, nobody photographed anybody doing that, let alone printed it in a newspaper or a magazine. And he was bending, other than, you know, bars, he was bending, you know, stereotypes and social faux pas, I guess. I mean, there are just these little things that people kind of don't think about anymore or take for granted that at the time period was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And at the same time, he would actively debunk as well.
Yes. Yeah, that was kind of later, in the later part of his life, he decided to kind of dedicate himself. I think it was because he was just getting a little too old to perform the escape acts that he was doing, and he wanted to prove that, well, I mean, he just basically would sue just about anybody that tried to copy him. And other than that, like, he wanted to prove that mystics and psychics were not real. And it was because I think he was duped at one point where he thought he was communicating with his father, and then he found out it was a scam, and then he decided to dedicate part of his life to kind of shaming people and exposing them. Which is kind of an interesting concept for my series because I do introduce real magic, and it's one of those things that, you know, what I'm playing with is the idea that Harry Houdini that we know of is very much this character in this book. Everything he's done, everything he said, is still rings true in this book, but there is an underlying history and, you know, decisions that he's made that kind of contradict that, but he has to put up a front, and he has. I mean, he's basically, at this point, he's creating an alias of himself. Like, he's Harry Houdini, who everyone knows, but he's also, you know, this spy, and he also can do things that are of, you know, not earthly things that he can. I mean, the idea that magic is very real, it's a source that he's tapped into. If he can tap into it, then others can too, and he is basically trying to defend America and its allies against a negative force that is deciding to try to overthrow him and take all of this power for themselves. So it's this kind of larger plot that goes on. But, you know, I wanted people to see, you know, Harry, and I didn't want to just show him doing his tricks. I thought it'd be more interesting to show Joseph doing the tricks himself in a more exciting way. So that was a lot of fun, was kind of figuring out the major acts, like the milk can escape, the straitjacket, you know, these escaping from Scotland Yard, these things that made him very famous. I wanted to kind of feature these escapes in the book, but show them in a new kind of fantastic way.
How long did it take you to make the first issue?
I'd say maybe 6 months. I mean, it was kind of slow going. We did the pitch last year, and the pitch was actually the last six pages of the issue. Pitched it around, got, you know, people really liked it, but nobody really kind of committed to it. And then I decided to just continue it, and I told Kevin, I was like, we should just continue this. I'd like to try to have this ready for Emerald City. He didn't make that deadline, but I was like, okay, Heroes Con is it. You know, this is a big show. I'm going to have a table. It's going to be great. There's going to be a lot of networking. I want to have this print copy so we can show people. And he got it done just under the wire, but it was about, 6 months in the making.
And so is it publicly available now, besides at the shows?
Through rechallenger.com, you can actually buy the first issue for $2.99, and it includes a 10-page backup comic that I wrote, and Isaac Goodhart was the artist on that. It's kind of a crime noir, kind of in Dashiell Hammett kind of vein.
Okay. And what's your at least tentative schedule then for issue two?
I'm giving Kevin, we discussed this, we'd like to try to have the next issue out in the next 6 weeks. It would probably be another black and white version. We've been getting a lot of good feedback from the black and white version that's out right now. Not that we're not going to do color, but we don't really need to expedite the coloring if we can keep churning out the issues black and white and then maybe collect it all as a colored book. But 6 weeks, every 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, we're hoping to kind of keep the momentum going and keeping people interested.
Yeah, I think the black and white worked completely well for it. I mean, there was no problem. And a lot of times it's just one of those things where you get into a tone and it's, you know, because this, I don't know, maybe because it was so old-timey just in thought, I didn't miss color, but I could see how, you know, obviously color is going to make something even more spectacular.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, Kevin is still doing everything old school. Like, he's still drawing, penciling, inking on actual comic book pages. He had all of them available at Heroes Con, which is really neat to see. And his level of detail and the craftsmanship he has in inking really comes through on those pages, because I think he just did a really great job. And it's something that sometimes you can lose doing it digitally, and he was going to try to do it digitally to kind of speed up his process, but I think he was having problems with his computer in Photoshop, so he decided to just kind of do it all by hand. But it came out really well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's great. I can't wait to see issue two.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I mean, I sent him issue three today, and he was like, he was so excited about it. He's like, I want to just draw issue three. I was like, yeah, let's draw issue two first. Issue three. He's like, okay. He's like, I'm just really excited. I'm like, awesome, because I'm excited, and you know, it's a fun story, and I think people, I don't know anyone who can't at least align themselves with magic in some way, and especially with Houdini. I mean, Houdini is a character that most people should know. Although when I was at Heroes, I was selling the book to people, and I said, oh, you know, how about this story? This is kind of a historical fiction. It's about Harry Houdini. And the guy was like, who's Harry Houdini?
Oh, wow.
It's like, really? And he thought about it. He's like, oh, wait, like that magic guy? I was like, yeah, the magic guy. That famous magic guy. That's it's like, okay. But I mean, even if someone doesn't really know, you still kind of know in the back of your head. Cause like, I've always obviously known of Houdini, but I knew nothing about him until I started doing research about a year ago, so.
Yeah, I know what you mean. A historical figure. I mean, you don't necessarily need to know everything about them, but you hope that they're at least recognizable.
Exactly.
And he was very distinct. I mean, it's one of those things where when you see a photo, I think he was just such a character, like you said, he was very recognizable, but... Yeah, I mean, if, you know, if somebody never followed the vaudeville and carnival type thing, they might not know.
Sure.
So we're going to segue into some other, like, just things that we were talking about before I started hitting record. But did you see the news today that, at least today, that the day that we're recording this, which is the 24th of June, that the author Richard Matheson died at the ripe old age of 87.
I did see that.
And so he's responsible for like a great deal of satire, thriller type fiction, if you will, stuff like I Am Legend and Hell House and Twilight Zone and Kolchak the Night Stalker. Did a famous Star Trek episode. So I saw that all of my nerd friends are in mourning today.
Yeah, I actually my best friend, that's one of his favorite authors, and I've actually never read any of his books, and I've seen The Twilight Zone, obviously, but my best friend would, whenever I'd mention it or we'd talk about something that reminded him of an episode of Twilight Zone or I Am Legend, he would just go into it and he'd just talk about it. He's like, story, man, you gotta read this story. It grips you. And like, I think there was one story in particular, I think it was called like Nightmare at 10,000 Feet or something, where it's like this passenger sees this, I guess it's like some kind of creature on the wing of the plane. And I distinctly remember seeing that in a Simpsons episode.
Oh, well, I think Simpsons did it, but it was...
Yeah, and that was like my first introduction to that, and I was like, wow, he's responsible for that, because that terrified me. And granted, it was filtered through an animated series, but it terrified me.
And yeah, I remember that Twilight Zone, though, because yeah. Twilight Zone scared the heck out of me. You and I were talking about how we're afraid of the dark, and not ashamed of it, but, you know, we live out in the country, and it's really effing dark. So I can't watch things like Supernatural in the dark. And it's a lot of fun when you hang out with horror writers, let me tell you.
I mean, I can watch gratuitous violence. That doesn't bother me. But, and if... Depending on the setting, like, in the context of a scary movie, if it's, say, like, Paranormal Activity, or, I think that was the one where it's, the movie starts out with this couple making dinner in their house, and I'm like, no, I cannot watch this because I do that every day. Like, I'll watch, Event Horizon, where it's on a space station, fine, that's scary, but I'm not freaking out when the movie's over.
You're not relating to it.
Yes, exactly. But, I mean, you show a girl crawling out of a TV. Like, no, I don't know.
No, I own it. No way.
Like, no, thank you.
Yeah, I'm pretty much a wuss with anything. And I love mysteries. So that's sort of the hard part, is for me to find something that has a good mystery without scaring the bejesus out of me.
Yes, yes. Like, the one, I think, that kind of was really tiptoed that line in a really good way was The Others. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't see that.
You should see that, because it's a really good thriller, and it's got suspenseful moments, but it's not like, I'm going to scare the shit out of you every 10 seconds. It's a really good movie. You should definitely check that one out.
That's cool. I will see if I can make it through a couple minutes of it without turning. Because that's literally, like, there's just times when somebody will send me a link for something, and I'll just be like, oh, made it 30 seconds. Like, there's a limit. And it's really embarrassing when, you know, when the screenwriter is trying to get you to, you know, or the original writer is trying to get you to watch something. I'm like, I cannot. I have all of the lights on, and I'm talking to you at the same time, and I can't do this. I'm like, this is not fair.
Yeah, when the house that I'm in now, it took me about a month. That sounds so bad, but it took me about a month to get used to just being upstairs by myself. Because when you live in New York and you live in Brooklyn, you don't have an upstairs. You have an apartment. That's it. One floor, that's it. Usually maybe one bedroom if you're lucky. And now we have two floors and three bedrooms, and, I mean, just all this space. So when my fiancé would be downstairs, I'd be really reluctant to go upstairs, or vice versa, because the kitchen is this huge kitchen with these wraparound windows, and we didn't have curtains up. And it was like in the middle of the night, she's like, hey, can you just unpack the dishes? So I'm doing it, and I just see my reflection in the windows, but I don't know who could be watching me. And it just freaked me out, and it took me about a month to just kind of get over it. Like, okay, I'm in Vermont. I'm in kind of it's not a rural town. I mean, it's kind of a nice town, but there's nobody out here that wants to hurt anybody. Everybody's very friendly. Like, just calm down.
Yeah, it's when I went from, you know, back and forth between, like, you know, condos and apartments back to the house. But it's like I had always lived in a house growing up. So then when I had an apartment and I had to hear neighbors, you know, for the first time, and hear it was like, it was sort of like retraining my brain, but then but I would sort of, I could stand, like I said, I would take the cat and I would go hide in my bed and, you know, close the door. And, you know, my cat luckily was really good. Like there usually wasn't any kind of worry that she would need to get to her litter box in the night or anything like that. She was awesome. She would sleep through the night. But, you know, there I would be, like, under all the blankets with the cat and, like, and, you know, I'd have to watch, like, pleasant things. Like, I would turn Psych on. I would just, like, put DVDs of Psych in. I'm like, I just need happy thoughts right now.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, it's eerie how we're on the same page about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, something like I Am Legend, to me, was not that kind of scary. Like, it was, that to me was more suspenseful and worrisome. But there's, I guess it does depend on really, like, how real something's feeling. Like, Scream, I have not forgiven the girl who made me watch Scream.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I just can't.
Well, yeah, it's also really a shame to admit this, but I haven't seen The Shining all the way through, and I've once was like, I need to see this movie. So I put it on in the middle of the day, and I couldn't get past the first 10 minutes.
No, just, I've only seen it in bits, like here and there.
The beginning and these long, like, dolly shots of just going through the house with the kid on the bike, it just creeped me out. And I was like, I can't do this. I can't do it. I can't. And I just had to turn it off.
Well, we all know that little kids are creepy.
Yeah, that's true. Very, very true.
Yeah, and then I know that Matheson also did things like Hell House and that sort of. I mean, there's so many haunted house remake type things that have all, like, 13 Ghosts was even technically like a haunted house.
Oh, I didn't know that. I like that movie.
They were kind of like all trapped in a house, and that's what I remember. That was Tony Shalhoub, right? Yeah.
Yeah. That movie was creepy. I mean,
it was.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really fun, and it was violent in a creepy way. It wasn't violent for being just violent, but, no, it was definitely kind of thrilling, and, like, I was like, I can kind of handle this. I think I can handle this.
Yeah, it ended, I think that ended more even-keeled and more upbeat and positive than just, like, everybody goes into a house and they all die.
Right.
You know, like, it wasn't that sort of thing.
Did you see Cabin in the Woods?
No.
Oh. That movie to me was, like, the idea for me, roller coasters were something I never liked as a kid, and I went on one years ago, and I just loved it. It was Rock and Roller Coaster. It was, like, this indoor roller coaster at Universal Studios, and it was like you go into the sound studio and it's Aerosmith and they're about to leave for a big party and you're like, oh, you should come with us. And you get in this roller coaster, which is a stretch limo, and the thing goes from 0 to 60 in like 5 seconds, and you're just in wall-to-wall sound on this neon highway going like 1,000 miles an hour. And it was awesome. And that was the day I was like, I think I can do roller coasters. And Cabin in the Woods was that same moment for scary movies where it's just like, I mean, granted, it's a huge parody on the genre.
Right, that's my
understanding. It was kind of creepy. But it was just so much fun.
Like, see, that's the thing, is like I'd have to be able to get through the story to get to the, you know, the parody acknowledgement.
Yeah. The parodies kind of happen almost immediately in that movie, which is kind of a relief when I was like, I'll go see this movie. And I liked it enough to take my best friend, and he had problems. He was like, that scared the shit out of me.
Okay. Yeah. I also have, I seem to have different panic levels depending on the size of the screen.
Really?
So if it's like, if I'm watching it on something like a relatively like smaller TV, and obviously during the day, you know, that's a whole different experience than me trying to go to the movies. I had a panic attack watching Signs, which is not a scary movie.
Really?
Yeah. And I was in the movie theater holding my, you know, holding somebody's hand and just crying. And like, and it was like the silent cry. Like, I was just there so frozen and tears coming down that they didn't even know that I was crying.
Wow.
I'm like, how could you not know that I was having a panic attack? So yeah, it's, you know, the scary movie thing is hard. I even tried to get over it by trying to write scary stories. Like, I tried to sit down as like sort of just a little challenge to myself,
mm-hmm.
and see if I could do a scary short story, and I failed miserably.
You scared yourself.
I couldn't even
do. Well, you know what? That sounds like you succeeded.
I couldn't even do like a page though. Like, I couldn't come up with something that I was comfortable enough creating. Mm-hmm. Like, I started, you know, got a couple paragraphs. And it was actually, you know, I was trying to use Darren Brown, one of his performances, as like an inspiration. And I was just like, God, I cannot do this any kind of justice.
Yeah, I think, I don't know who I was mentioning this to, but there was a short anthology that someone had posted about to contribute to. And I think it was about true crime stories. And I was like, sweet, I'll totally look into that. And I was doing some research on true crime stories, and I came up with this. I read the scariest things. Like, just unsolved mysteries to me freak me out. They just freak me out. And actually, part of the research of Houdini was, I was doing research on Scotland Yard, and evidently, I think it was like 1903. I forget the date. It was at the turn of the century when the old building was being abandoned and they were building a new one. But I think it was like kind of in the same area of London. And it's known as, I forget what the, I'm forgetting the name, but it was like the name of the street, but it was like, say it was like White Street. It was like the White Murders. And apparently in the building that they were renovating, they found a woman that was basically hacked up. And it's just, for a police station to find a murder in their building and to not be able to solve it, it's like, man, that's creepy.
Like, yeah, that's just nuts. Whitechapel, maybe?
Yeah. I think that's what it was. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of a strange coincidence that.
Yeah, when something happens, like, right under your nose. In fact, I just started, I tried to watch the BBC show Luther a while ago, and I really couldn't get into it. So yesterday, I was a complete and utter slug and just sat in the air conditioning and turned on a bunch of different shows throughout the day, and I started rewatching Luther. And in this one episode, there's this obvious, like, creep sociopath killer who puts on, like, the creepiest mask ever.
Oh, really?
So he's got the hoodie and the mask. And he is, like, literally live streaming through the internet his, you know, an attack. And, like, they're trying to identify the street and the address and all that stuff. And it's like, yeah, this is kind of crazy shit that probably really could happen.
Yeah. I mean, like, whenever I see a movie, I was talking about this with my best friend, whenever we watch a movie with, like, a bank heist, and it's a really clever one, my best friend always brings up this point. He's like, why didn't the writers just say, screw a movie, let's just do this and we'll be millionaires? Because it's such a great heist, it's like, it would totally work. Yeah. I was like, yeah, that's a good point. And like, it's the same thing with, like, you know, the serial killer movies. It's like, that's a really clever way to kill someone.
You've just given a bunch of people an idea.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's me watching every episode of Leverage.
Oh, okay.
like, I should totally be able to steal that man A.
Oh, and yeah, that's actually a funny point, because my fiance is a curator at the Fine Arts Museum here at the college in Middlebury, and you know, the first thing that I asked her when I found out what she did for a living, I was like, so movies like Thomas Crown Affair, and she kind of just stopped me. She was like, no, museums don't have that kind of security. People don't actually do that. That is all made up. I was like, really? She's like, yeah, museums don't have that money.
They don't have the money.
It's like, so to steal a painting might actually be kind of easy because the security is kind of light, but people just don't do it. But she did have some pretty good stories about things being swiped from museums that she worked at.
I did a museum heist short story, so I hope to someday have that out for
people
to read. Yeah, I worked really hard on that. Not as hard as this historical fiction piece, but but pretty darn hard.
Well, as far as research, would you say you're is it primarily on the internet?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because as having a art historian as a fiance, she's kind of a stickler about research. Like, she finds me doing research on the internet not research. She's like, that does not count. You need to just go to a library. I was well, like, really?
I kind of feel that way, but at the same time, I'm like, first of all, I live in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Second of all, the museums, like, that I have in mind aren't, you know, I, even though, because of my modeling and stuff, I basically had a museum in mind that was going to be my fictional museum, and it was one of these museums where I worked. So, I don't think that I can just go in there and, you know, I'm used to working with artists. That means I don't know anybody in security. I don't know anybody in administration. I can't just go in there and start asking questions and go, oh, really? Swear to God, I'm a writer. I want to know about your security system. I mean, you know, it seemed a little out there and crazy. So instead, I just started researching security systems online. And I did actually find about some, like, you know, small-size museum heists and, you know, like security systems that had been implemented. And it's just like some simple stuff, like, you know, the rotating cameras and, you know, and no, the stuff's really not that great, but it's better than nothing.
That's true.
Sort of like all of our closed circuit surveillance. It's like when you watch the stuff on crime dramas, it's like, oh, these pictures are immaculate no matter what time of night it is, and you can zoom in, and you can get every detail of a person's features, and you can do facial recognition, and it's like, no, you can barely freaking make out the human form.
Yeah, any show that features, like, computer hacking or whatnot, it's just a fancy graphic on a screen. It's like, no, that's just, it's not that sexy.
Yeah, I know, right?
But, yeah, I mean, as far as research, like, I don't have an excuse because I do have a humongous library in my backyard, practically, because I live on a college campus, more or less. But yeah, there, I mean, there are some things that I told her. I was like, you can't find in a book. Like, yes, the stuff that I'm doing about Houdini, you know, I've really kind of gone and researched, even if there are books that have been copied and put up on, you know, Google Docs or something. So I'm actually looking at historical text.
Right, I was just going to bring that up, that there's so much that's already been scanned and available.
Yeah, it's, and she is right, though. Like, some of the stuff that I found, as far as, like, other characters incorporated in the story that I didn't know anything about were, like, the Martinka brothers. So the Martinka brothers had a shop in what is now considered Chelsea in Manhattan, but they had their shop was basically across the East Coast, was the place, like, the mecca to go to prove yourself as a magician. And this was very real. I had no idea that this existed. And this is kind of where Harry got his start, because he was part of, I think, like, there were maybe a dozen guys that would come to perform new tricks, and they had their specialties. And Harry was the handcuff king. And so, yeah, the fact that I found all of this through, you know, just an old book that was on Google Docs was pretty awesome. Kevin had sent it to me, so I just dug through it. And, I mean, that's definitely something I couldn't have found out on the internet, because I wouldn't have known that I was looking for it. So a lot of the research that I did up front has changed because, you know, I'm reading all these new things, and, you know, inspiration kind of hits you differently when you're kind of really far along into a project. So it really did help a lot and shape kind of the whole plot and how the first arc is going to end and who's involved and all that. So it's been really, really informative.
So have you ever wanted to give up on a story once you started it?
There's only one story that I did. But other than that, for me, I don't believe any really good story. If you really believe the story is great, it will never die. You'll find a way to make it, whether it's revising it, whether it's finding another artist, whether it's adapting it into some other form. But everything I've put out, with the exception of one story, I haven't really given up on. Houdini is one of the rare examples where it was an idea from the start. It kind of went into production, and we just made it. Another project that I'm going to, I guess I'll have ready in a few weeks to kind of pitch around, is a story that has gone through so many revisions. It's gone through 3 different title changes, which is the most for anything I've ever worked on. It's gone through 4 different artists at this point. But I believe in it, and I believe in it so much that I actually scripted the entire thing. It's a 4-issue mini, And I just scripted it because I wanted to have it done. I wanted to finish it. That was my only goal this year, was to just finish projects. So I finished two so far. Houdini is 3 issues out of 5 done. There's another series I'm co-writing with someone that's 4 issues out of 6 done. So like I feel good that I'm kind of achieving my goals.
The reason that I was so glad that we were scheduled to talk about this today is because one of my artist friends is just ready to give up. He's like been doing this for 20 years, and you know, is sort of at that point where he's like, okay, I understand that people earn their sort of like, you know, the fame and fortune of comics, which we all know is kind of a joke.
Yep.
But the recognition and the getting the job offers and at least getting even creator owned stuff with a really reputable publisher, you know, like after 15 or 20 years, you sort of expect to be there already. And the fact that there's plenty of good people who still aren't there, it's discouraging. So, like, I'm, like, way newbie. I'm, like, just starting out and discouraged half the time. So I'm just more or less like, well, whatever. It's not, you know, like, my life depends on it if this doesn't get done. But you're at this, you know, higher elevated step where, you know, like you said, you know that you needed to get stuff done. And you just, like, tasked yourself with completion. So what was your encouragement?
That's kind of come in a couple different forms. I think early on when I was co-hosting a writer's podcast with Ryan K. Lindsay and Curtis Weave, that was kind of a really good reigniter. I think we were recording it started out every 2 weeks. I think it got stretched every 4 weeks. But every time we talk, you know, we kind of bitched about the same stuff, like, you know, just life getting in the way, or just, you know, trying to get something somewhere and some publisher, and just talking it out was very therapeutic, and that was really helpful. And that worked for a very long time until obviously the show's kind of stalled and we haven't recorded in a while, and Curtis had to step away, and Ryan and I both, you know, the work we're doing now has I'd say tripled since we started the show, like a year and a half ago.
Yeah, well, he's busy with all that pony stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
He was on. If you guys don't know Ryan K. Lindsay, go back a few episodes. He was on the show.
Yeah, great guy. And
it's hilarious.
Yeah, so you know that worked for a while, and then I actually kind of got frustrated because I wasn't where I wanted to be. My closest friends, including some of my siblings, are accomplished. They set out to do something and they did it. Like my oldest brother is a doctor. My oldest sister is a lawyer. I'm a triplet, so I have 2 triplet brothers. One of them is a lead texture painter. He worked for ILM for many years. He's working in a different studio in Vancouver now. He's worked on Watchmen, The Incredible Hulk, some, you know, huge movies. And my other brother is owns a CrossFit gym down in Miami, and you know, he set out to do it, and he's doing it. Now he's, you know, kind of almost at the verge where he's going to open a second location. And I still don't feel like I've gotten to the point where they are all at, where they set out to do something, they're doing it, and they're expanding upon that. So I was getting really discouraged, and I realized there was a twofold problem I was having. One was I was too obsessed with publishing, and that I was too focused on trying to make projects work that just weren't working. Like I maybe couldn't find an artist, or the artists working on the projects were having to take their time because they were getting other work. Prime example was Cobble Hill and Southern Dog were 2 books that came out last October that I worked on. And those artists, because of those books, got some attention, and they now have paid projects. And like Selena, for the artist on Cobble Hill, she's got a really great paid project has allowed her to go full time, which is great, but you know, it's kind of made our project kind of on the back burner, which is something I don't fault her for at all. So I was getting really frustrated with these two things, and what I realized first was I need to start just creating new stories, because you know, I had this conversation with Steve Niles, who I've become friends with, and he was telling me that, you know, he thinks it's funny that people call him a prolific writer, because he doesn't really necessarily view himself that way, because you know, when he got something made, when 30 Days a Night became big, it wasn't like he was writing new things. They were like, what else you got? And he was just emptying drawers. He's like, that's what you got to do. You just got to empty drawers when the time comes. And that's what I was like, I need to shift my focus on that because I need to just create new properties. I need new things to work on because that was my release and relief was finding something new to work on. Like when I started working on something new, and Tim Daniel, who I'm co-writing a couple projects with, he was instrumental in this because he would just call me. He's like, hey, I got this idea. He pitched me a one-liner. I'm like, I love it. I'll send you a one-page synopsis next week and we'll work on it. And that was a really good motivator. And then as far as publishing, something I realized, particularly with Houdini, was that I don't need to focus on publishing. Because what I was doing was I was focusing on an idea that doesn't really exist. That idea was, I want to be a published writer. Well, you can't really become a published writer if that's all you think about, because you're not actually writing anything. You're holding on to this lofty ideal, this concept, but it's not real. And what I needed to focus on was actually just producing work, because I want to produce work at a caliber that I'm not knocking on editors' doors, they're knocking on my door. And I know of plenty of guys that have produced work where that was the result. It was just so good that people had to notice. And they weren't focused on, oh, can you just greenlight this project for me? Can I just hope this works out. I hope this submission goes through. And then, you know, I would just dwell on those things. I would just dwell on a submission letter. And at the end of the day, I hadn't produced anything. So those were big things.
I remember back when I had started writing more, and this was before I even got into comics. This was many years ago. And, you know, if I went and heard authors speaking at bookshops and stuff, everybody would ask about finding an agent, because this was long before, you know, self-publishing became as easy as it is right now. And every writer would say the exact same thing and say, well, what have you gotten finished? You know, where is your story done? You can't ask about finding an agent or selling your work to a publisher or whatever until it's done.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if anybody is ever curious about that, by the way, that sort of like whole process, if you hashtag ask agent on Twitter, every once in a while there will be sort of like a just very simple like Q&A session with literary agents, including Eric Rubin, who's been a guest on the show. But it's obviously different in comics because we don't need agents.
Right.
But we do need art teams.
Yeah, you do need art teams. And with creator-owned comics, the writer most often than not becomes the editor, the production designer, the publisher at some times. So, I mean, it's one of those things that anybody who wants to write comics, don't focus on getting published. Like, have that as a goal, but don't have it as like the end all be all, because, you know, you just need to focus on writing good stories. I want to, you know, write stories that, you know, I mean, the conversation about an agent is that, or even like working in traditional publishing or even working in film and TV, is that you've got to impress other people. You've got, you know, with movies, you've got to impress dozens of people to get one project made. And in comics, the only person you need to impress is the artist. And that's something I focus on. I write for the artist. I want the artist to be excited because that gets me excited and we produce a comic book. Everything else is just, you know, icing on the cake. And, you know, when I stopped focusing on that, I just was a lot more happier with writing every day. Like it didn't feel like such a chore, like, oh, I got to do this in order to feel good about maybe getting publishing. I just feel good about just writing. It's like, oh, I wrote 10 pages today. Awesome. And that's, you know, just wake up and do it again.
Yeah, because I consider myself very, very slow. I'm slow at reading and I'm slow at writing. So if I script a mere 2 pages, I've tried to just sort of change my thoughts and say, oh my God, I only wrote 2 pages, into, well, I wrote 2 pages today that wouldn't have gotten written if I didn't do it.
Exactly.
You know, my goal might be 60 pages, and it might take me a whole lot longer than other people who can crank that out in a few weeks. But, you know, if I get my 2 pages and I'm happy with them, then I just need to be okay with that.
Yeah, and something that I tell everyone is, I had read this quote from Brian Michael Bendis when I first started, and he said something along the lines of, every day you're not writing, someone steals your dream job. And I think about that every day. And, you know, that's what motivates me to write, because I want to get my dream job. And in order to do that, I just got to keep writing. I don't have to focus on anything else. Like, literally nothing else matters. Just do the work, and everything will kind of work out as they're supposed to.
Let me ask you a couple process questions.
Sure.
Have you ever started to hate your characters, or at least one of your characters in a story?
Oh, that's a great question. Think about this. I don't know if I'd necessarily say I hate them. Because I kind of have to align with them in some way in order to write them. But,
did they ever start taking on their own, like, because I've had that struggle where I'm like, you're not doing what I expected you to be doing right now. Like, I expected you to be the good guy and you're turning into an asshole.
There's a minor character, or I guess a supporting character in this comic, Sleep Debt, that's gone through several revisions and I'm going to have ready next month, where he's a supporting character who is supposed to be not very good, not very nice. And, you know, it's kind of hard to, like, it got to a point where he was, by the fourth issue, he was speaking, like, I felt like he was speaking for himself, like, I wasn't having to think about what he'd say in certain situations, but it was kind of like channeling a side of myself that I'd never be in public, like, just being kind of rude and offensive and, you know, all these things that I think I could theoretically be. But, yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to write characters you want to hate. I just write a character that I think is not so good, and hopefully people are like, hey, I kind of hate that guy because he's not very good.
Well, the first time that I consciously noticed this in reading was when I started reading Clive Cussler. I started with the book Sahara, and that was, like, a decade before the movie. I was, like, getting on a plane, and I didn't know what to do, so I, you know, went to the newsstand and bought a book. And so, the character, all of the characters at that point were, they had so many books out, and I didn't even realize, like, at what point in the series I was. I just picked it up, and I was able to read it from there. And I loved them so much. And so I was reading the series forward from that point on, from Sahara on. And then I didn't realize that my dad actually had, like, this whole collection.
Oh, wow.
So he gave me this giant-ass box filled with Clive Cussler books. So I tried to go back to the beginning and read the beginning. And this character, Dirk Pitt, was such a raging douchebag in the, that I couldn't finish the first book. I'm like, you are just a fucking creep. You're, like, practically assaulting this woman on a beach. I fucking hate you. You are not the character that I know and love.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it was like, you know, here Clive Cussler took, you know, 10, 12 books or whatever to get to the point where this character was, had been, you know, this evolution of him. And, you know, then iconically played by Matthew McConaughey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was just wondering, you know, I would love to talk to the author and just go, geez, did you realize that what you did?
Yeah, it's one of those things where when I think about it, I don't, in books and comics, there isn't, or the ones I've been writing, like, I'm not really aware of those types of characters. I feel them very strongly in TV shows and movies. Like, there are characters that you just hate and you just want to see die horrible deaths. But I guess that's a really interesting point. I'd actually like to kind of reread some of the stuff I've written to see if I did any of that intentionally or if at all, because it's definitely something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think usually characters go on to a more of a path of redemption. I mean, I think that even when they start out as heinous individuals, there's always some sort of, you know, penance.
Well, I guess I guess the best example of something I've written would be Southern Dog, where, you know, it's this kid who lives in the deep South, and it's, you know, 6 weeks before Obama's inauguration, and he's surrounded by racism, blatant racism, and he's even picking up on, or he's sensing that his dad kind of aligns with that worldview. And something that I was very conscious of when writing about the father was that, you know, in the context of how he treats his son as a father, he is what would be considered an exceptional father. He's attentive, he's supportive, he's loving, everything that you want a dad to be, except he just has this one quirk where he sees the world very differently. And the one thing I wanted people to read from that issue is that, yeah, you find this big reveal at the end of the first issue that maybe he's not someone you want to trust or even like, but you can't help but like him throughout the story because he's done nothing to lead you astray. And, you know, because I've met people like that where, you know, they are good-natured people, but they just have different worldviews that I can't align with. And growing up overseas, I saw that all the time. Growing up overseas, it was very common that the society and the culture that you grew up in your household might completely contrast the one that you were living within, depending on the country. And it just, you learn to adapt and appreciate and acknowledge different cultures almost simultaneously. So it was a very interesting way of growing up. But, yeah, I guess that was something that I was very conscious of because I wanted to write about someone who is kind of evil in a lot of ways, but not in the kind of obvious ones, for sure.
Right, and you obviously have these, see, you and I were talking about being introverted and extroverted, and how I don't think that we're taught the definitions very well, and I can remember, you know, geez, like, in grammar school and high school and stuff, you have to take these personality tests, and, you know, a lot of it's just for kicks, just to see where you fall on these charts and diagrams and things. And I can remember when one of them, it was, we did this, I think, in an English creative writing class or something, and what I remember them saying was stuff like, oh, introverts are shy people, and extroverts are outgoing people, and I don't know that that's really true, because later on in college I had it explained a lot better, which was that introverts can find inspiration inside themselves, even though obviously we're all influenced by our world,
right?
But that they sort of, not that you retreat, it's sort of, when you say things like shy, it makes it sound like you're a hermit, and you're retreating, and you're antisocial, and extroverts are these, you know, histrionic, wild, and crazy, you know, insane right. people. And it's more like, no, you get your inspirations and your drive from inside yourself, or you get the inspirations and, you know, drive from external sources. And that felt a little bit better and less insulting definitions.
No, for sure, for sure. And you know, I didn't actually figure out the difference until, it sounds so weird, but like March when I was in Seattle, I mentioned to you before we recorded, I was hanging out with my friend Curtis Weeb, and he was telling me about introvert, extrovert, and I was like, listening, I was like, yeah, no, I'm an extrovert. And he's like, I don't know about that. Because, yeah, that's my idea of it. My whole life was, because I like to socialize, I'm extrovert. And I almost kind of taught myself to be that when I moved to New York. I mean, I was extremely shy throughout high school and college, like painfully shy. Like, I don't even recognize myself back then. And what changed was when I moved to New York, I was really fascinated and kind of mildly obsessed with the book Catcher in the Rye as a kid. And I was so intrigued by the character of Holden Caulfield because I always used to think when I'd read that book, like, I could never be that guy. He would just find himself, and he put himself consciously in these awkward, like, weird situations. And it was just so awkward to read. And when I moved to New York, I remember thinking, I'm going to be Holden Caulfield. I'm just going to go out and just put myself in awkward situations, even if it kills me, just to get out of my shell. And yeah, one year in New York, it's all it takes to be a social person. But that doesn't mean that I was, you know, an extrovert. Like, I really had to kind of almost train myself to be that. And, you know, I'm really an introvert. I prefer to recharge my battery by myself, and I don't need other people to do that, and I need that quiet time. So
yeah, and I remember, you know, very distinct changes where I am quite sure that I, like, switched from one to the other, because yeah. I really did like, not that I liked being alone, I just always felt friendless, you know, and it wasn't by choice. I just sort of felt like, well, you know, I'm not popular, and I didn't have sisters, and I think that really makes a big difference. Like, you're part of triplets. I mean,
yeah,
that's like awesome.
I mean, like, I always had friends, I guess, because of my brothers, but you know, when I got to high school, I really distanced myself from them, like, as much as possible. We played basketball our entire lives. Like, that's all we wanted to do. That's like, when I was in fifth grade, I thought I was going to play in the NBA, like some crazy pipe dream. And then when I got to high school, I just didn't like being associated as one of the Holtz. Like, oh, you're one of the Holtz. And it's like, I have an identity. I'm a person. I'm not this, you know, I'm not part of a collective. And that's why I was like, I'm going to do something that they wouldn't. So I decided to do theater, and I did theater for the rest of high school because I was like, they'll never get on stage. And that also helped me kind of get out of my shell a bit. But
what did it for me too, because in college, it was one of those things where I had no major, like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I really thought that I was going to join the Army after high school.
Really?
And that was it. And I would figure out my shit there. And with circumstances of, you know, my family, it was like, no, you will not. So I was like, okay, then I'm going to apply to, you know, the big state university because I'm an A student. Didn't get in. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? So I went to, like, the smallest, you know, private school in the area, and I had to pick a major, and I didn't know what to do. And I'm like, well, I really like film. Let me see if there's a film program. Well, there's no film program. Oh. Okay, well, they have a TV program. Oh, no, that's gone too. Okay, they have a radio program. All right, there we go. I'm like, fucking sign me up. That's it. It was like literally days before orientation. I had no plan. And so it wasn't until somebody...
You had to declare before orientation?
Well, yeah, you had to like pick out... Yeah, you had to pick out your courses. I mean, you could have, you didn't have to. Like, you could have done all your core stuff.
Oh, sure, sure.
But I, you know, I needed a plan, because that's the way I am. And I can remember, like, my first time trying to talk into a microphone and just being so scared to death of it. And I'm like, I'm in this room by myself, and I'm talking out loud. This is bizarre shit. And
well, you know, what's really bizarre about hearing yourself is when I started doing the podcast with Ryan Curtis, the first time I heard my voice, it's so weird, but it sounded like both my brothers' voices mixed together.
That
like,
is weird.
I remember thinking, like, I kind of hear myself, but I kind of hear my brothers. This is so weird. Like, it was a really weird out-of-body experience. And yeah, doing enough recordings, you kind of slow down your speech, you try not to repeat yourself. I mean, all these little things that you kind of get used to.
Right. I mean, yeah, it was obviously, you know, incorporating theater was part of what we had to do.
Absolutely.
And our theater professor was very hard on me. But he was just very hard on everybody, on absolutely everybody. But I think because I sort of, like, I guess I looked up to him in such a strange way that not too many people did. I was like scared of him but attached to him, and I just wanted to do well. So, and it wasn't like in a kiss ass kind of way necessarily, but I knew that he was, you know, his wife was an actress as well, and they were obviously like crazy about, you know, British culture and British theater and all that stuff. So, you know, like I did an entire like Rowan Atkinson
skit, oh, wow,
as like, you know, a 20-minute, you know, lecture or whatever one time, and I was just like, I am so ace in this class. And it, you know, and that's the way it was. I mean, like when I did like some little, like, you know, the little soliloquy from Hamlet or whatever, like I did that Dead Poet Society thing where like I climbed up on the top of the desk and did it on top of a desk. You know, this is all like shit that I would never have thought that I was capable of doing.
Yeah. And honestly, just how I even got into comics was pure accident. But when I found that, when I decided that I was going to do it, and, you know, the first thing I ever wrote, I sent it to my older brother, who was really the guy who got me back into comics, just reading them. And he doesn't give praise lightly. Like, something's got to be good for him to even acknowledge it. So I sent him this thing, which, actually right now, looking back on it, was not very good. But he read it at some point, and he called me, and he's like, hey, I just read your script for this comic book. It's fucking amazing. I was like, really? No, seriously? Seriously, what'd you think of it? He's like, no. I literally read it from page one to the end. It's good. It's great. And then I was like, I think I've discovered what I need to do with my life. And that was that's another constant motivator for me, is that I know that there's nothing else I want to create in this world other than comic books, because nothing else feels like a reflex. Like, I don't get up and want to do anything else. Like, comics is it. That's what I want to be making.
And hopefully, if anybody, you know, or if you in particular, you know, if you have that moment where you're like, I can't do this anymore, or I need a break, or I'm not succeeding to my own expectations enough, take a damn break. It's okay. Yeah. You know, yeah, if you're already not the golden child and on every, you know, blog headline, then, you know, people are so afraid that they're going to disappear. And that the thought of disappearing is really, I think it's frightening to most people. Other people choose it because they just need to get away.
Sure.
But, you know, if you already think of yourself as, like, you know, not being a household name, then don't worry about it. Don't worry about that part. Take a break.
Yeah.
And rejuvenate and take care of yourself, take care of your, you know, your body and your mental state and your family. And, you know, it's comics. They'll be here when you get back.
Yeah, I mean, there's no shame in letting life get in the way sometimes. I mean, I went through a pretty horrible breakup, and that kind of sidelined me for, like, months. I'd say, like, maybe 2 or 3 months I didn't write anything. And that's okay. I mean, stuff's going to happen. And the thing is that everybody struggles. Even the people that I know that are considered established struggle. And that's just the name of this game. And comic books is, like, I really wish I remember where I heard this, but I once heard someone say on a panel, comic books will never love you. And I think it's so true. Like, comic books will never love you. You just have to have that unconditional love yourself and just keep making the books that you want to make, and nothing else matters. I mean, if you and your artists are excited about it, that's all that matters. People will pick up on that energy, and they'll read it, and they'll like it, and you'll be on your way.
Yeah, that's pretty great reminder and motivation, basically, in its own way. That's whenever we can find something that kicks our ass into gear, you know, it's helpful. Well, before I let you go, we have to get some important information, like where people can find you and learn about After Houdini and learn about where to follow you.
Yeah, After Houdini is through readchallenger.com. So that's available right now. And I'm constantly on Twitter. It's just Jeremy_Holt. I have a website, which is clumpoftrees.wordpress.com. I also have a column that I was writing for Multiversity Comics called Strangelove, which you can actually check out on multiversitycomics.com. There's about 16 installments there that kind of chronicalizes the first 4 years of me breaking in or attempting to break in. So there's a lot of really helpful advice there as far as you know, experiences I've personally had with editors, publishers, with, you know, the ups and downs of life with comics. So it's a interesting story, I'd like to think, and you know, a lot of people come up to me at shows and mention how, you know, it really helped inform them. So yeah, anybody can get a lot of information from that.
All right, and of course you guys can follow me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber and get everything else that you need to know at amberunmasked.com. You can look for Amber Unmasked on Facebook to find the page, and Google Plus. I'm on there too, Amber Love on Google Plus. Jeremy, thanks so much for this amazing and informative and fun time.
Oh, thank you so much. This is really great.
I absolutely love it. This is, you know, as long as I can steal you away from Ryan, I think I'm just going to keep having you on.
That works. I think he'll be okay with that.
I think he'll be all right. All right. Well, he'll just have to keep coming back too.
Yes.
You know, that dreaded time zone issue, but what great fun.
Absolutely.
All right, everybody, you know, take care of yourselves, and don't forget to check out After Houdini by Jeremy Holtz.